Torah Jazz, session number 42. Whoa, 42, amazing. We are at Parshat Chayei Sarah, the life of Sarah. There's a lot of good, meaty Rashis here at the beginning of the Parsha. We're going to jump into them and see what depths we could learn about the life and the death of Sarah. So we're going to start off with the first Drasha and Rashi, which like this. The first verse tells us how many years Sarah lived to be. She lived to be 127. Now, if I was writing the Chumash, that's pretty much what I would say. She lived to be 127. But the Chumash does not use that language, does not express it that way. Rather, it says in the Chumash, and the life of Sarah was 100 years and 20 years and 7 years, the years of the life of Sarah. So we see that Sarah's years are written differently. And as a matter of fact, Sarah's years are actually written differently than anybody else in the entire Chumash, so much so that it brings Rashi to understand that the Chumash is trying to tell us that each one of these categories of years is meant to be looked at separately as its own unique drasha or exegetical interpretation. So 100 years, says Rashi, is coupled with the idea of 20 years, that at 100 years, she was like someone who was at 20 years, in regards to what? In regards to sin. Why? Because at the age of 20, a person's sins are not yet judged by the heavenly courts. At the age of 12 or 13, a person's sins are already judged in the earthly courts, because otherwise we would have chaos and anarchy, right? If someone does something wrong, the courts need to deal with it. But as far as spiritual responsibility, that only comes at the age of 21. And that had nothing to do with the age of being able to buy alcohol, because anyway, she lived in Israel where you could buy alcohol from a younger age. So that's the first drasha. The second drasha, 20 and 7, is at 20 she had the beauty of a child of 7. So the explanation to that, we wonder, well, what do you mean? We don't normally think of 7-year-olds as being beautiful. Normally we think of 20-year-olds as being more beautiful than 7-year-olds, says the Gur Aryeh. The Maharal here explains that the concept we're speaking about is being unblemished, flawless, right? A 7-year-old has that unblemished flawlessness to their body. At the age of 20, she maintained that. And then the end, right, these were the years of Sarah's life, comes to include all these things that throughout her whole life she maintained a perfection in her physical expression in the world and also in her spiritual expression in the world. Now, there are those Rishonim who flip it and even mention that there are other versions of this Rashi where it gets flipped and goes the other way around, that at 100 she was like 20 for beauty, right? The standard concept of beauty reaches its peak at the age of 20. And at the age of 20, like a 7-year-old for sin, meaning that she was clean of a sin like a 7-year-old who hasn't even really reached, fully come into the age of discipline, of chinuch, where they fully understand what the consequences of their actions are. That's a nice, this flipping it comes out really nicely, because as we'll see later on, when Abraham passes away, and the Torah uses a similar language, only it's one drasha there, and not two different drashas, that Avram is like 100 like he was at 70, at 70 like he was at 5, clean of sin. So then they work parallel very nicely. The question, which always tickled me in the back of my mind, sort of bothered me for many years, and it's not one of those type of questions, you know, atom bomb, blow everything up questions. It's a curiosity question. It's a, isn't that funny? Isn't that interesting? And those questions are always so worth exploring, because they always open up new avenues and new thoughts in these areas. And that question is as follows. Rashi's drush over here is so specific. It's 100 to 20 to 7. Avram's drush is not so specific. 100 to 7 to 5 for sin, and that's it. Here it's exactly 20, either because of 20's relationship to sin or to beauty, and exactly like 7, either because of 7's relationships to sin or beauty. Now on 7, maybe we could swing a little bit lower, maybe we could swing a little bit higher, but the point is that if Sarah lived any longer than that, we would have ruined Rashi's drasha. If she lived to be 132 years old, five more years, Rashi's whole drasha is going to go out the window. So it seems like Sarah has to live to be 127 years old, because if not, we're going to ruin the entire drasha. Now, I'm saying that in sort of a funny way, an exaggerated way, because we'll see that, in a sense, that actually is the case, and we'll explore why that is a little bit further on. Next verse, end of the verse, all of a sudden, Sarah dies, V'tama Sarah b'Kiryat Arba, Sarah dies in Kiryat Arba, hi Chevron, that is the city known as Chevron, Be'eretz Kna'an, in the land of the Canaanites, V'yavo Avraham, and Avraham comes. Whoa! So where was Avraham this whole time? Sarah dies. We don't know why yet or what caused it, but we know that Avram wasn't there. He comes. So Rashi, in order to answer this question, tells us where Avram was, which is Be'er Sheva. Now, how does Rashi know that Avram was in Be'er Sheva? Well, if you were paying attention in shul last week, you would have seen that at the end of Parshas Va'era, that was the very last place we see Avraham going to. So if the Torah finds it of importance to let us know that he is now coming, that means it is significant for us to know where he is coming from and why he is coming. And we know that in last week's Parsha, Avraham was fresh off of the Akedah, the binding of Yitzchak, the greatest of Avraham's 10 tests, the final test, according to almost all of the Rishonim. And that is the last location where we see him heading off to Be'er Sheva before he turns around and comes to Kiryat Arba for the burial of Sarah. The verse goes on. V'yavo Avram, Avram comes, lispod l'Sarah velivkota. He comes to eulogize Sarah and to cry for her. Now the question in Rashi, why Rashi's drasha is connecting the two ideas of the Akedah and Sarah's death, why it comes specifically on this idea of the mourning and the crying, that's a little bit trickier. But let's look at Rashi's drasha first. Rashi tells us, Lispod Sar v'liv kota, v'nismacha misa sar l'akedas Yitzchak. The Chumash is purposefully connecting the events of the death of the death of Sarah to the binding of Yitzchak to Akedat Yitzchak. Why? Lefi shayadei besort ha'akedah shnizdamet b'na l'shchita v'kimat shlo nishchat parcha nishmasa mimena v'meisa. What happened? When Sarah found out the news, the message, that Yitzchak was being taken by his father to be shechted, to be slaughtered, and he's almost slaughtered, that kills her. Okay, one thing at a time. First of all, what question is bothering Rashi that that's the answer that answers that question? So it's explained very nicely in the Hadar Skenim of the Bali Tosfos, this idea that you see that the verse, that the hesped came before the crying, the eulogy came before the crying, right? He came to eulogize her and to cry for her. And the normal way of things is for a person to cry first and eulogize second. More than that, the Bali Tosfos wanted to bring a raya from the Gemara and Moed Katan that says that after a person dies, it's customary to have 3 days for crying and 7 days for eulogy. So you see that the crying, the healthy way of mourning is to cry first for 3 days and then to eulogize for 7. And here the eulogy comes before the crying. So what we do see from that is that Sarah's death was sudden. Something sudden occurs that Avraham does not have time to get to Kiryat Arba in time to be there before the passing. He's only there after Sarah is already dead and everybody is already in the midst of eulogizing. So Avram has to eulogize first, and only after does he get to cry. which means that the crying has a smaller effect than normal. And as a matter of fact, if you pay close attention, if you look in your Chumash, that word, Veliv Kota, is written with what's called a Kaf Zeira, which means that the letter Kaf is written smaller than the other letters around it. And that's an unusual thing. Doesn't occur often that the letters get big and wonky and little and small, right? It's not a teenage girl's doodle notebook. It's the Chumash. So when a letter comes bigger or smaller, it's because Hashem is trying to teach us another idea that we're missing inside the verse. So over here, we see in Rashi that the crying was minimized. The small kaf is coming to show us this idea that there was no time for a proper crying. And somehow, this is all connected to the idea of the Akedah. And that's really going to bring out our first big question, which is, what is it about the Akedah? Why is that, of all things, the cause of Sarah's death? Normally, when great people die, we don't necessarily know what caused their death. Maybe it was a certain period of time, or they sort of fulfilled their mission in the world. Here, there's this sort of mashup of the Akedah coming in. The final test that Avram has to go through is actually the thing that ends the life of Sarah. Now, it's interesting, Rashi, in Rashi's answer over here, he takes the idea from the Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar. Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar brings this idea that the Satan, the force of evil in the world, which maybe we'll understand a little bit more clearly what the Satan exactly is as we talk about these different ideas, did not succeed in stopping Avraham from accomplishing the Akedah. And so in his disappointment, he comes to Sarah and he tells her about this event. Sounds like almost an act of vengeance. And it so surprises her and catches her off guard that she goes into a traumatic state and her soul leaves her. Now, Rashi changes it a little bit. It's interesting that Rashi doesn't mention that it's the Satan. Rashi just says when she hears the message. And also, Rashi adds this idea that she heard that Yitzchak almost dies. And when she heard that Yitzchak almost dies, that's when her soul leaves her. Now, that's strange, and it begs the question, if she heard that Yitzchak was still alive, that seems to be a good thing. That means that everything worked out and everything went well. Why is it that that sort of a news is what ends her life? And maybe we'll ask it a little bit stronger, sharper, because Avram himself also has to hear about the Akedah, because he's the one who has to go and actually do it. And Hashem comes to Avram and tells him, look, you need to take Yitzchak and you need to shecht him. So as far as Avram knows, Yitzchak is as good as dead. And Avram not only doesn't die, he packs up his own donkey the next morning and heads out at the crack of dawn in order to do this. Sarah, when she finds out that Yitzchak almost dies, that's too much. It overwhelms her and it kills her. So why is it that this is the message, the send-off for Sarah? Now, we mentioned a little bit about her 127 years. So let's just say it right now. The Eitz Yosef on the Medrash. The Medrash brings over here this verse, Yodea Hashem Yemei Tmimim. Hashem knows the days of those who are tamim, those who are innocent, those who are perfect in their walking with Hashem, and understands that it's coming to tell us that Sarah, who is the example of that, is living to the full extent of her life. That means she is meant to live exactly 127 years. So why is the Akedah the cause of her death? Says the Eitz Yosef, look, everybody's got to die somehow. So that's how Sarah died. She found out through the Akedah. And it's a surprising answer. We'll revisit it, try to maybe deepen it, see how we can understand the Eitz Yosef a little bit more deeply and better. But I would say like this. When we think about righteous people, and we're saying over here that Sarah is clearly a righteous person, right? That's what the whole verse is expressing. But when Aaron, for example, dies, he gets a whole ceremony. He goes up the mountain, they change his clothes, he lies on a bed, and he has a death through what's called neshika, right? Hashem kisses him. It's the most pleasant, amazing form of death a person can have. Their soul simply goes into the next world. And as a matter of fact, we learn that Moshe and Miriam also had that death. This was the death which Bilam yearned for, the death of the way that Jewish righteous people pass away. That is a far cry from what is happening from Sarah being traumatized to death with the news of her son being nearly killed. So what do we see? If we jump over, Rashi tells us in last week's Parsha, when Avram receives the commandment to go and perform the Akedah, he doesn't just receive it in a sort of straightforward, blurt-out fashion what's about to happen. Avram has the concept of the Akedah revealed to him gradually, giving him room to sort of accustom himself to the idea, to even believe at the beginning that it's not Yitzchak. Sarah, on the other hand, hears it in one unceremonious shot. Now, certainly Hashem could have found a way, right? If it's so important for Avram to hear it slowly, certainly we could have found a way for Sarah to hear it slowly as well. And as a matter of fact, the first reason Rashi says why Avraham receives it slowly is exactly Shiloi Titarv Daito, that Hashem shouldn't overwhelm him, shouldn't traumatize him when he tells him this idea. So why does Avraham merit to have that slow revelation, and Sarah seems to not merit to have that slow revelation? By the way, interestingly enough, and we always have to be careful when you look for the sources in Rashi, the Gemara over there brings the source, I believe, from the Gemara in Sanhedrin. We're about to talk about it and look at it now. But Rashi's second answer does not come from the Gemara. Rashi rather brings together both the Gemara and Sanhedrin, and also the Bereshis Rabbah, the Medrash, which says that the other reason Hashem gave it to Avraham slowly over time was in order to make the mitzvah more beloved to him, and in order to give him reward for every word and word. And Rashi bringing all those three together, he's saying them as one idea. So that's also an important idea to understand how those three concepts actually fit together. One of them seems like a practical thing. Don't explode a person's brain with the most frightening mitzvah ever given to man. The second one seems like a gift to make him love it more, to give him greater reward for each word and word. How are those flip sides of one similar idea? Okay, before we explore that Gemara over there in Sanhedrin, first we're going to look at a piece of Gemara in Bava Kamma, Daf Tzadi Gimel, which deals exactly with the beginning of our Parsha, and as a matter of fact, should shed a lot of light on all the questions that we've asked so far. The Gemara over there shares with us the following idea. Hamoser din al chavero nenash hu tchila. The one who passes over judgment or passes along judgment upon his friend, he is punished first. And the idea over there the Gemara is referring to is that whenever someone has a quarrel, there's a quarrel between two people, we have all sorts of systems in place in order to deal with that quarrel. And of course, the most obvious one is the Beis Din, the earthly courts. However, if a person takes that din, that judgment, that quarrel, and passes it over to the heavenly courts, the Beis Din Shel Mala, that's called Moser Din Al Chavero. And that person is punished before his friend is punished. And the source for that is actually from Sarah. And what that means is that in some way, her death at the beginning of our parsha is actually a punishment for something that she did many, many, many years before. What is it that Sarah did? Where did we see that she passes judgment on her fellow man over to the heavenly courts? So if you go over in your Chumash, let your fingers dance across, to Bereshit, the book of Genesis, Tet Zion, Pasuk Hey, verse 5. We see that over there, the continuation of the story of the challenge of Avram and Sarah of having children. Both of them were infertile, and therefore they were not able to have children. After Avram receives, at the age of 75, the prophecy from Hashem that he will have children in the land of Israel, Avram and Sarah try to have children for 10 years, but they are not successful. So at the age of 85, Sarah, in an act of kindness, gives Avraham her handmaiden, Hagar, in order to attempt to have children with her. For perhaps she was fertile, and at least the seed of Avraham could exist and thrive through Hagar. Avraham does that, Hagar becomes pregnant, and as a matter of fact, haughty towards Sarah, and Sarah is not pleased with these events, and she accuses Avraham of not praying for her to get pregnant, and only praying for himself. And the end of that verse, she says to Avram, Yishpot Hashem beini uveinecha. Hashem will judge between you and I. Although in Hebrew it's me and you. So what do we see? That Sarah is asking Hashem to be the judge between her and Avraham. And when that is the case, the Gemara lets us know you have done a very serious thing. Because if you invoke the heavenly courts, you have invoked the absolute pure version of din, of divine justice. And that's much harsher than earthly justice. And you gotta pass the test first. Because if you're not clean from all transgression, you are in very big trouble. So we see that, as a matter of fact, Sarah does pass judgment over to the heavenly court, and therefore, according to the Gemara, she is being punished first. And that's why she dies before Avraham. The Bereshis Rabbah, the Medrash over here, actually learns that she should have lived another 38 years. And then she would die together with Avraham, because she would have been 165 when Avraham is 175, and they would have died together. But the fact that she passed undue harsh judgment onto Avraham, she loses that opportunity and dies 38 years earlier. And yes, I know what you're thinking. She can't live another 38 years, because if she does, she's gonna mess up Rashi's drasha. I know, I'm with you. We'll get to it. So we see now, wrapping it up through this first stage, this sudden early death of Sarah with a minimized bechi, a minimized crying, that's all part of the onesh that she had for passing din over Avraham. So now, two questions. Let's just get them out there. You ready? Number one, this whole story that the Gemara in Bava Kamma is quoting happens when Avram is 85 years old and Sarah is 75, which means it took 52 years for the punishment to come. So then, why now? Why not 50 years? Why not 54 years? Why not 20 years? That's a long time, 52 years, and seems almost an arbitrary amount of time from the time she passes the judgment over to the heavenly courts to the time that something actually happens. Question number two, what was she actually punished for? Was she wrong? Was something wrong about the claim she made about Avraham? When she asked Hashem to judge, was there some mistake that they found? Some issue that Sarah indeed deserves to be punished before Avraham? And especially since it sounds like it's something between the two of them, Beni uveinecha. Okay, there are those who explain the idea locally, different ideas of what should have happened, should they have divorced, what should they have done. We're going to leave that, we're going to take a different approach. And that approach brings us, finally, to the Gemara in Sanhedrin. Well, I think we've mentioned it thrice now. We are on page Peites Amud Beis, that is page 89, folio B. And over here, the Gemara wants to elaborate on the story of the Akedah itself. Bum, 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 big stuff. The Parsha of the Akedah begins with the following verse. Vayhi achar hadvarim ha'ele, and it came to pass after these things. Ve'alukim nisas Avraham, and Hashem tests Avraham. Amr Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan says, Mishum Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra, achar dvarav shel satan. In Hebrew, achar hadvarim could mean two possible things. After the events, or it could also mean after the words. So we don't know exactly what event triggered the Akedah, because the Chumash is telling us something did trigger the Akedah after these things. Something was causational in the Akedah having to occur. So the Rabbi Yochanan, the name of Rabbi Yossi ben Zimra, understands that Dvarim is referring to words, and which words specifically were we referring to? Dvarav shel Satan. The words of the Satan. Dichsiv, as it says, V'yigdal yel v'gmal, the boy grew up, and he was weaned from his mother. What happens over there at the age of two? Yitzchak is weaned, and back then, they made a big party for weaning babies. Nowadays, we make lots of parties for babies. As a matter of fact, we even make parties for 30-year-old babies. But back then, the big party was when the baby turned two and he was weaned from his mother. It was the sign of the beginning of an independent life, a child who was growing to take responsibility for himself and in turn for the rest of the world. So it was a very big party. Lots of very famous people came there. Enner was there. Eshkol was there. Mamre was there. Avimelech was there. All the big names. It was a who's celebrity gathering. Comes along the Satan and says before Hashem the following: Ribono shel Olam, Master of the Universe, this old man, he played one, no, this old man, at 100 years you graced him with a child. He makes this whole gala from the whole event that he made. He didn't have one pigeon, one little bird that he could bring you as a sacrifice. The pigeon, the little bird that he's referring to, is the sin offering of a poor person, right? A person who can afford it brings a sheep. Someone who can't afford it gets off the hook with a little birdie. So he says there's a huge party. Avram invites everybody. It's a whole big shindig. There's not one little, you know, little piece of chicken, one little birdie that Avram could bring and sacrifice to Hashem as a show of gratitude? Really? So the Satan is coming out and making a claim that Avram is thinking only of himself and not being grateful for the gift which Hashem has given him. Responds Hashem, this man has done nothing than for the sake of his son. Meaning his whole life, everything he did was for this son. If I tell him, go and sacrifice this son for me, right away, he would do it. Right away, Hashem tested Avraham. We got some questions. We're going to hold on to them. We'll come back. V'yomar kachnas bincha. He says, take your son. Remember, this is what we spoke about. Now, the Gemara interjects and adds here one more idea. In that Hashem says to Avram, Kach no es bincha. And the word no, that language, is language we reserve for a request, a favor. So it sounds like Hashem, not only is this not a punishment, in the second version, it sounds like Hashem is asking Avraham for a favor. Like this. Mashal Lemelech Basar Vadam. Here is a parable of a king of flesh and blood, like all good Jewish parables begin. That there were many wars, and he had one mighty warrior who won them. And many days passed, and there was a tremendous war happening, one particularly tremendous war. And the king goes to the warrior, and he says, I request of you, do me this one favor. Win this war for me, so they shouldn't say, bleh, all those earlier wars, nah, they weren't really such a big deal, right? If you can't win the big war, then all the little wars were really just a fluke. So too, Hashem says to Avraham, I tested you with many tests, right? You went through many trials. You stood in all of them. Please stand in this final test. So they shouldn't say that the first tests were no big deal. Meaning if you can't pass the Akedah, all those other tests, meh, not such a big deal. Okay, now the famous drasha, your son, I have two sons. Your single son, your only son rather, your only son, I have an only son from one mother, and an only son from a different mother that you love, I have mercy on them both. And the Medrash says love. Yitzchak! Okay, so why didn't he just say from the beginning, take Yitzchak? Kol kach lamali, asked the Medrash. Why so many words? In order to not overwhelm, traumatize Avraham. So now the Satan goes out, and of course he's going to make it onto the road before Avraham does. I mean, this is his whole plan. He's very excited. He has a lot to do. He wants to make sure Avraham is not going to succeed in this test. So he comes along, and we're not going to do it inside because there's a lot of hard verses from Eov, and we'll give the general gist because different commentaries understand them differently. But basically the concept is that he comes along and he says to him, how could it be, Avraham? How could it be that this is from Hashem? You must have made a mistake. Hashem doesn't want you to do this. Everything he promised you was for this son, and now he's going to ask you to throw it away. And Avram says, Ani betumi eilech, I go with innocence. I don't ask questions. That's the response. And then the Satan comes back to him. He says, look at this. You're going to look like a fool. You told all the nations of the world not to sacrifice their children, not to practice idolatry, and now you're going to go sacrifice your son. How could that be what Hashem wants? He says, Mihu naki avad. What person was clean? Meaning, did everything Hashem asked him to do, and he ever lost out, and he saw that he could not influence Avraham to stop. Okay, that's the Gemara. Good stuff. Always worth seeing it inside. But that is the idea. Questions. Let's ask some questions now. Because I got a lot about them. I don't know about you, but I got about five right here. All right, question number one. Once again, we are having really big chronology issues. We see that the Akedah was some sort of a punishment. Sarah and Avraham acted like ingrates. They did not bring a korban. So therefore, they must be tested with the most difficult test imaginable to all of mankind, the sacrifice of their one and only beloved child, the future of the Jewish people. That party was 35 years before the actual Akedah. The Gemara said that the Satan came, he made that claim to Hashem, and right away Hashem comes to test Avraham, but it wasn't right away. There were 35 years between the party and the test. Good. One question. Question two. Was the Satan right? The Satan came along and he made this claim that they weren't really thinking of Hashem. And Hashem never actually answers the Satan back as to whether they did, whether they didn't. Hashem simply says, well, you know what? If I asked him to give his son, he would do it. Well, maybe yes, maybe no, but that doesn't really undo whether or not he made a mistake at the party in the first place. You hear a second question? Question two? Hashem doesn't really answer the accusation that Avraham did anything wrong. Rather, he just says, well, if I tried him in something else, he would do even better. Okay, good. Three, wow, that's a really extreme response, right? Well, you know what? If I ask him to kill his son, he'll do it. I mean, that's harsh. There's nothing in the middle. Question four. The parable that we brought in of the king and the soldier makes it sound like Avram's doing a favor to Hashem. So are these two ideas contradicting each other? That the first one sounds like a punishment to Avraham for not offering a sacrifice, and the second one sounds like a favor Avram has to do to Hashem. Number five, interestingly enough, we see when the Satan comes to Avraham, he has no challenge, well, we shouldn't say no challenge, but rather he succeeds in deflecting the words of the Satan and is able to go ahead and carry out his duty. But when the Satan comes to Sarah, she is totally defenseless, has no way of pushing off the Satan, and that brings it to her end. What was it that Avram had that he was able to fight the evil Satan and Sarah could not? Good. Those are our five questions. And hopefully this will start to give us a lot of clarity on our earlier question. So here's the idea. Okay. The request that Hashem makes of Avraham and the claim that the Satan has against Avraham are in fact one and the same thing. And what way do we mean? We've spoken about it in other Torah jazzes that Avraham is breaking new ground in creating a new definition for what it means to be a righteous person. Lech lecha, go for yourself, for your own benefit. Yes, you're right, the job of the tzaddik, of the righteous person, is to represent Hashem in the world. And you can do that, as a matter of fact, by doing for yourself. Because if all your intentions are for the sake of heaven, when you do for yourself and become greater, as a matter of fact, you are elevating and picking up the entire world with you. And so Avraham, and as a matter of fact, all of the forefathers, or three fathers who are forefathers, are known as the Merkava, God's chariot in the world. They're known as the Mizbeach, the altar. As a matter of fact, after Avram's circumcision, the Medrash itself talks about this idea that Avram has turned himself into an altar. The blessings go into Avram's hands. That means that all the flow of goodness in the world actually moves through the righteous person, through the tzaddik. And we'll see that, fascinatingly enough, this idea is from Rav Yashel Ber Soloveitchik, the Soloveitchik of Boston, that we see that Avraham builds several altars in the Chumash. What's interesting about those altars is we see that Avraham never offers any sacrifices on any of those altars. So we see that Avraham, unlike anybody else we've encountered, builds altars, but doesn't bring sacrifices. And as a matter of fact, never brings any sacrifices. The only sacrifice we ever see is the one that Hashem tells him to in the covenant between the parts, the Bris Bein HaBesarim, where Avraham cuts up a bunch of animals, lines them up, and walks through them. Okay, so the idea, explains Rav Soloveitchik, is that we bring sacrifices, we bring offerings onto the Mizbeach because we need a visualization, we need a hamchasha, we need hitgashmut, we need a physical way to represent spiritual concepts which are very distant for us. That as a matter of fact, we are sacrificing part of ourselves on the altar, and that's why we bring physical things onto the altar. Avraham was on a level where his whole life was a life of self-sacrifice, that all he needed was the altar. He did not need that physical representation. He understood what it meant to sacrifice yourself. That's exactly what he was. So everything he did, all the eating he did, all the drinking he did, it was all for Hashem. It was all bringing sacrifice. But what we need to understand is when we talk about the Satan, the Kitrug, the voice, the accusing angel in the heavens, we have to remove ourselves from the concept of a little red man with big pointy horns and a pointy tail and a trident and a goatee, of course, because why wouldn't the devil have a goatee? That's obvious. Rather, it's a force that pushes against our sort of flowing in the world to bring us to higher levels of greatness. So the world at large has a claim against righteous people because, okay, we want to state that Avram could go to this party and he could have filet mignon and he could have sushi and there could be, you know, all sorts of extravagance over there. And that is not a contradiction to a life of piety, because all of those things he's doing to elevate Hashem in the world, it's not for him because he likes sushi and he likes filet mignon. It's because he wants Hashem to be great, and so he brings the greatest possible things. But the person sitting next to him looks at him and says, "Oh, there's no difference between me and Avraham. When I made a wedding for my child, my son, my daughter, I also brought the best food and the best band. He eats, I eat. He sleeps, I sleep. He has a car, I have a car. He has a house, I have a house. There's no difference between the two of us." Now, obviously, that's ridiculous and it's not true. I mean, especially if some of the houses that righteous people live in certainly doesn't look like some of the houses that other people live in. But the idea behind the claim is that these righteous people, they pretend that everything they do is for Hashem, right? That's the claim. They pretend it's all for Hashem. But they like ice cream, just like I like ice cream, and they enjoy it when they eat it. So that's not for Hashem. That's for you. They don't really care about Hashem. They're really taking for themselves. So Yitzchak is really for the world. He's not because Avraham and Sarah need to have a child to shower their affection on to make them feel good about themselves. Yitzchak is to make the world a better place. But there is a claim in the world that they care more about Yitzchak for themselves than for Hashem. So now, is the Satan right in his claim against Avram, or is the Satan wrong? Well, of course, everything Avram does is already an offer, a sacrifice. And so it's not a contradiction or a showing of a lack of gratitude if Avram does not bring a korban at the festivities. However, as the world sees it, Avram did not bring a sacrifice. He didn't bring a korban. Maybe he's really not so grateful. Maybe this whole tzaddik thing is an exterior thing, but inside he's selfish, just like the rest of us. So Hashem says to Avram, "Do me a favor. You've really done nothing wrong. However, there's this perception in the world that all your sacrifice was superficial. And therefore, says Avram, I'm going to put you through the ultimate test, the ultimate sacrifice, a sign that everything you have is really for me and not for you. And so therefore, the ultimate test born out of this claim in the world against all tzaddikim is also a favor for Hashem, because it shows that Hashem's righteous ones do everything for Hashem and not for themselves, and it will silence all the critics. Now, the way that Avraham receives this commandment is through slow revelation. What's the significance of slow revelation? That is the big difference maker between Avraham and Sarah. And the answer to that we find in the Mesillas Yesharim's very beautiful explanation of the attribute of mercy, Rachamim. Avram's entire work in the world is to slowly reveal the attributes of Hashem's mercy. And the concept of mercy, says the Mesillas Yesharim, is very misunderstood. Because mercy, clemency, means that a judgment has been passed, and now I'm going to be merciful. I'm going to be lenient on what you truly deserve and go easy on you. And it seems to be a contradiction to the attribute of justice. Says the Maharal, that is not true. but the world cannot flourish and thrive under pure heavenly justice, because life in this world is a process. And therefore, if you make a mistake, you need time to correct that mistake. Pure heavenly justice, lightning bolts from heaven, you do something wrong, you forgot to make a bracha, boom! But that's not how it works. Because if it did, we'd all have very frizzy hair. We need time to learn from our mistakes, to stumble, fall, catch ourselves, fix it. When a person comes to do tshuva, when a person repents, he is, in a matter of fact, sacrificing himself, uprooting everything he used to be and becoming somebody else. And so it's not a contradiction to justice to have mercy. Rather, it is Hashem's form of higher justice in order to allow justice in the lower world a chance to do its job and to thrive properly. So the difference between mercy and pure justice is that mercy softens the punishment, spreads out the time. When Avram receives his revelation for this mitzvah, he gets it slowly, one word at a time, displaying this attribute of mercy that Hashem gives it to him one piece at a time. Once Avraham realizes that this whole favor, commandment that Hashem is giving to him is coming to him through mercy. Hashem didn't drop it on his head. This is a judgment against tzaddikim. Go sacrifice your son. But rather, he does it slowly, with time and space. And Avram realizes that everything is coming to him through the attribute of mercy, through Hashem's love, and through Hashem's chesed. Now, we go back to the story of Sarah. What does Sarah accuse Avraham of? It's the same accusation. Avraham, you only daven for yourself. You didn't daven for me. Here I was. I thought you were the greatest Baal Chesed in the whole world. And yet, when it came to children, you didn't think of me. Let Hashem judge between the two of us. She questions Avraham's Chesed, and therefore, this Nisayon, remember that all the trials that Avram goes through are Sarah's trials as well. She's there every step of the way. The two of the trials are when Sarah is taken away from Avraham by Paro and Avimelech. Now she's the one who was forcibly taken into strange palaces under the threat of being forced to do horrible things with strange men. So those trials are trials for her as well. This trial of the Akedah is very much the same way that it's a trial for him as a trial for her. The difference is that when it comes to whether or not tzaddikim take for themselves or if it's all for Hashem, she has to receive the trial with straight din, straight heavenly justice, because she asked Hashem to be the judge between her and Avraham. And while Avraham can receive the mitzvah through the attribute of mercy, for all the mercy and kindness that he does, Sarah has no choice but to receive it in pure justice, since she has passed on the judgment to the heavenly courts. Just about their character in general, by the way, we do see that Avraham and Sarah balance each other out. There are those two sides of Rachamim and Din, of Chesed and Din. Avraham's name, right? He gets the name Avraham. He's Av Hamon Goyim. He's the father of many nations. Sarai, my princess, becomes Sarah. She's the princess of the entire world. But we see the difference between an Av, a father, who always has mercy on his children, as opposed to Sarah, coming from the word Sar, an officer, a ruler. which is, of course, the attribute of justice. So what happens? It doesn't matter whether Yitzchak survives the Keter or doesn't. I mean, obviously, ultimately, it does. But for Sarah receiving the news, when she hears how serious the claim against Tzaddikim is, to the point that Yitzchak has almost lost his life just in order for the world to understand, that overwhelms her. Avram, on the other hand, receives it in a way that he realizes that despite not understanding why he has to do this, despite it seeming to contradict everything he knows, he sees that if it's coming through God's mercy, there has to be something good on the other side of it. And therefore, Avram has the tools to push away the Satan, to refute his claims, to say to him, I don't know, I don't understand, but mercy is higher than justice. And if this is what Hashem is telling me to do through his mercy, something great will happen at the end, and Sarah does not have those tools. Now, why is this occurring at this stage of their lives? Again, we point out this is 35 years after the party goes down. Okay, so now we're hoping to answer up a bunch of questions in one fell swoop. Here we go. There's a very famous Yalkut Shimoni, maybe the most famous Yalkut Shimoni, I don't know. Rabbi Akiva, when he used to want to wake up his students, he used to point out that there was a parallel between the years of Sarah's life and the exact number of countries that fell under Queen Esther's rule. And he asks them, how did it come to be that Esther merited to have 127 different countries under her rule? Because she was Basbita Shel Sarah. She was the scion of Sarah, who lived to be 127 years old. So what do we see? One country for each year of Sarah's life. What does it all mean? There's a beautiful Chiddush Harim, very famous, that brings up this concept that each day was treated with purpose, no wasted time. Each day was like a house. Each week was like a city, each month like a province, each year like a country. What do we see? That Sarah lived her life to maximum potential with full years. So we see once again this idea that Sarah merits to live the full length of her life. Every year, every moment is being maximized and used to its absolute potential. And yet still, we seem to understand that years were taken off of her life. So we'll go back to the Tosos Hadar Skenim and the Kaf Zeira. Why is the Kaf little? We saw in Rashi this idea that the crying is minimized. But why the Kaf? Could have been a different letter for all we know. The Tosos Hadar Skenim, taking a different approach than the Medrash, say something very interesting. The Kaf is because she lost 20 years of her life. How did Tosfos get to the idea that she lost 20 years of her life? Because we do see that her grandson, Yaakov, lived to be 147, which according to the Bali Tosfos is not a coincidence. Sarah had the potential also to live to 147, but because of her sin, she lost 20 years of her life. Okay, this idea of 20, why 20? And I'm throwing an idea out there, just a possible idea. It was fascinating to me that this idea of 20 years of your life, we also see in the Gemara in Yevamos, on Daf Kuf Hey, page 105, folio A. Over there, they talk about the decrees that are set in the heavens. And one such case is that on the house of Eli, the Kohen, that Hashem promises that the offspring of Eli will have shortened lives. Now, both the great Amoraim Rabbah and Abaye were descendants of the house of Eli. And what's interesting is that Rabbah lives to be 40 years old. And that seems to make sense to the Gemara. But Abaye lives to be 60. And that is a very big surprise. If they're both meant to have shortened lives, how does Rabbah make it to 40, but Abaye makes it to 60? Well, first of all, what we do see is, as we saw earlier, that Yodea Hashem Yemei Tmimim, Rabbah lives to be 40 because Rabbah was a righteous person, and therefore he lives the full length of his days. Just so happens that the length of his days is short, 40 years, but he lives all of them. However, Abaye, says the Gemara, like this: Rabbah and Abaye both learned Torah, and through that merit lived the length of their days. However, Abaye involved himself in chesed, and therefore he lives an extra 20 years. That's how he makes it to 60. Why is 20 years the number of chesed? I can't say that I fully understand. Maybe it's an idea of, you know, 2 times 10 spheros, chesed towards the heavens, chesed towards the earth. I don't know, but we do see this parallel concept of 20 years, that chesed adds 20 years to your life. And going with the approach of the Tosos Hardei Skenim, it would make it very beautiful. Why is it that the Akedah has to wait till Sarah is 127 years old? Because Sarah is fully expressing, through the attribute of strict justice, those things that she needs to express in the world, these concepts of beauty and purity, physically and spiritually. And so she has to live the full 127 years of her life. And so the Akedah, this test, has to be held off until she reaches her 127 years, and therefore Rashi's drasha still stands. However, had she lived her life fully invested in the attribute of chesed, had she not turned so powerfully against Avraham with the attribute of strict justice in that one moment, I mean, this was really seemingly Sarah's biggest trial in the pregnancy of Hagar, that it somehow minimized all the chesed that they had done and did not allow her the extra 20-year push to bring her to her 147. Now, had she lived to 147, what can you say? Rashi's drasha would have been ruined. Seemingly, of course, Hashem would have expressed that concept somehow else, or rather, alternatively, that the 147 would have been a greater, higher, different expression of a even bigger level that Sarah merited, beyond the one that the strict attribute of justice would have allowed her to reach. So with that, we answered, I hope, all those questions we set out in that very meaty beginning of our parsha over here. The 100, the 20, and the 7, the full years of the life that Sarah truly merits through all her accomplishments and through the strict attribute of justice as well, the connection of the two events of the Akedah with the death of Sarah, because that is the ultimate test, reflection for Sarah of the justice she turned over to Avraham, which can only occur now in the 127th year of her life. And that is what brings Avraham to not be with her and have to minimize the crying for the great righteous tzedekis, Sarah. May she be a merit for all of us, and may you all have a beautiful Shabbat.